Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Cathode Ray Mission. I'm your host, Adam Ferens, and tonight I'm joined by Aaron White. Say hello.
Hello.
Sydney DeZeno, say hello.
Hey there.
Jay Bryant, say hello.
You're not the boss of me, but okay, hello.
And Perry Sabert, say hello.
I've never played on a kit that small.
29 pieces,
yeah.
Right?
Mm. Only too shy of Neil Peart, yeah? So if you haven't guessed, tonight's topic is the one season wonder, Freaks and Geeks. And what a wonder it is. Wonderful show, in many ways a miracle of modern television. This is a show that, you know, I've often said I wish it would have lasted longer, and I came to it much later, but at the same time I also wonder if we'd gotten more than those 18 episodes, could it have kept up the quality and would it have ruined the memories? But that's something we'll get into. So Freaks and Geeks, for those who don't know, was a comedy drama set in a high school in Michigan in 1980 from creator Paul Feige, and produced by him and Judd Apatow. This series has, well, a plethora of future stars that we'll get into, and the two main storylines are about the freaks and the geeks. The freaks are the burnouts, the washouts, the kids that are considered the so-called losers, the ones that probably won't make it out of high school, and how one girl, following the death of her grandmother, decides to give up all signs of success in order to join them. And at the same time, her brother and his two best friends, who are entering their first year of high school, and they are the geeks. So I want to throw this to Sydney first. So Sydney, how did you first come to this show?
I actually had zero idea the show even existed until, I'm pretty sure I was at least the middle of college, and one of my good friends just gave it to me as a box set for my birthday or Christmas or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he insisted we watch it together, and now that's our all-time favorite show. And I was really sad there was only not even a whole season, it's two-thirds of a season. And I was, it's also one of those shows where I hate the ending. I have a few of those where I love the show, but makes me angry.
Mm-hmm.
But I obviously came to it much later.
Yeah. So, Aaron, how did you become aware or first come to this show?
I was 12 years old when this show came out, and I obviously did not see its original run because it ran at 10 o'clock on Friday nights, but I did see it the summer after its initial run when they moved it immediately to Fox Family and aired the full 18 episodes, because NBC only aired the first, they screwed it up so bad. But they showed 16 of the 18 episodes or 15 of the 18 or whatever. Fox Family took the show. They showed all of it in order. And I saw it fairly immediately, and I know that because I knew James Franco when I saw Spider-Man the next year as the guy from Freaks and Geeks. So that was pretty exciting to be the only person in my friend group who knew who James Franco was because he was in the group and he watched Freaks and Geeks.
So what about you, Perry? How did you first become aware of this?
So I was a bit older. I was 26 when this came out in 99. And I was 4 years out of college, and I had gotten to a place where I was noticing and not minding how much less television I was watching in my life at that point. But this came with so much buzz on it, and I remember watching the pilot when it aired, and I said to myself, and it's the only time I've ever done this, that is so good it will never last on network television, and I didn't watch any more of it because I didn't want to be left. I didn't want to watch, you know, 8 episodes and be left with nothing. And then when I heard that, you know, that they knew this as they were filming it, I can't remember if it's Apatow or Feig who says that they knew halfway through the run they were filming these to be watched at the television museum, that they weren't going to get renewed. And I thought, okay, so they actually wrote an ending. And I didn't see the whole thing until Shout Factory put it out on DVD. That's when I bought it and watched the entire series and have never stopped watching it. I'm not saying it's the best one and done ever, but it is my favorite one and done series in the history of network television. I think it's absolutely genius.
Yeah, this is one of three, maybe four one and done shows that are basically like 1A, B, C, and D. And I came to it about 5 or 6 years ago as part of my ongoing top 300 project. After many people had said, hey, you got to try this. And I was like, come on, no. And I eventually started to find out little things about it. And I went, wait, it's set in Michigan. Well, it does have an interesting cast. And then I watched it. And it now sits firmly in the top 35, 40 shows that have ever been on television, as far as I'm concerned. This is a really special show. So now we come to Jay. So, Jay, why don't you tell our audience how you first came to Freaks and Geeks?
All righty. Well, I'm clearly the old man here. When this show crossed my radar, I was a grown-up, you know, legal age, over 40, as a matter of fact. I was 41 years old. I was working for Disney Channel, primarily as a story analyst, though I'd been a writer as well. I'd just written my first produced script there for a show called So Weird. But I was doing a lot of coverage for a development executive there, an old friend of mine, and he told me one day, I'm not sure exactly when this was, I think it would have been early in 99, that he was thinking of taking a job at NBC. And they had given him some pilots to watch. And he asked me to take a look at them and give my opinion and maybe write up some coverage for him because I assumed they were going to come up, you know, in his interview or something. But so he gave me two. He only gave me two. One was Stark Raving Mad, that Ring Any Bells kid, Neil Patrick Harris and Tony Shalhoub, who was actually a very good pilot. And I liked that a lot. And the other one was this thing called Freaks and Geeks, which had nobody I knew in it, you know, and I thought, well, let's see what this is about. And, of course, I liked that, too. I was actually close to the real time, you know, I was in high school just actually a few years before the setting of the show. So this was fairly familiar to me from that level. I do remember thinking that I thought there were some aspects of it that were maybe a little too Disney Channel for NBC, but looking back, I mean, that was my first reaction. I don't think I've ever had that feeling since, you know, when I rewatched the pilot, including this week, I rewatched it again. But at the time I thought, well, maybe this, I don't know if this is going to fly at NBC or not, but anyway, I gave them some notes on it. And then they did put it on the air, that September, both of them, actually, both of those shows. And neither one did very well, but I noticed week to week, I was loving Freaks and Geeks and not hating Stark Raving Mad, but not really caring about it. But Freaks and Geeks just keeps getting richer and richer as it goes because, you know, the characters are so deep and so well observed, and it's just well, like everybody's been saying here, pretty much, you know, it becomes a favorite. It just, if you love it, you love it. I'm sure there are people now who come to it late and who see it and think, well, what's the big deal? It's distracting to see maybe James Franco and Jason Segel and all these familiar faces, maybe. But at the time, man, when it was new, they were all new. I just fell in love with it. I watched it all the way through. Of course, I was PO'd, to say the least, when they didn't show them all and when they canceled it. I watched, of course, the when Family, ABC Family picked it up. Or was it Fox Family? I can't remember. But anyway, I watched those three. And when it came to the cast and creators did a talk, a Q&A at one of those Paley events, Paley Center mm-hmm. events, I went to that. I went to the Museum of Radio and Television that Apatow was talking about when they showed them all there. A lot of the cast showed up for those too and would introduce them. So I saw it all again that way. When it came out on DVD, I saw it all again. When it came out on Netflix, I saw it all again. And now it's on Hulu. I'm 6 episodes in. So, yeah, I just love it. And I always kind of thought it was kind of cool to get on. Feel like I got in sort of on the ground floor, but like that. But, yeah, I don't know. That's basically the story.
Yeah, no, that's very cool. It's always nice to hear that, you have these two pilots and, you know, you like one, you think the one's going to be a hit, but you kind of love the other one, but you're not sure about its prospects, and that ends up being the one that ends up, yeah, they both failed commercially at first, but one has endured and actually become not only beloved, but has actually had pretty damn good sales on disc.
Yeah. It's so relatable. And there's nothing wrong with Stock Raving Mad, but it was about Neil Patrick Harris and this Stephen King sort of writer. And I don't know. I mean, I can't even remember exactly the full premise. It was very well done, but it just didn't resonate that way, you know?
Yeah, and you know, we talked about the cast in Freaks and Geeks, but hey, Neil Patrick Harris and Tony Shalhoub, that's an interesting pairing.
Yeah.
But moving on to the next question, back to you, Sydney. Let's ask this. Do you think that this is more of a comedy, or is it a drama with comedic elements?
Oh, it's absolutely a drama with comedic elements, especially after seeing the rest of, like, the catalog of Judd Apatow and Paul Feig's work. It's definitely more, I don't want to say highbrow, because it's just short of that, but it's definitely not a long fart joke, which I do appreciate at the end of the day. And I feel like it hit more very serious things than it gave you belly laughs, even though there are some very funny parts.
You know, it's interesting that you talk about some of the serious things that it hit, some of the serious notes. The storyline late in the series where you find out that one of the characters, the Seth Rogen character's girlfriend, is intersex. They handle that so well, so maturely, and so matter-of-factly that it astonishes me that it was made when it was made in 1999, 2000,
yeah.
and that it wasn't on cable. It also, to me, I was discussing this with Aaron the other day, that storyline, you know, there's another show that came a few years before this that it often gets compared to, and that's My So-Called Life. And My So-Called Life had some LGBT material in it as well and gets rightly credited for its own bit of groundbreaking. But there's something about that show that seems a little more patting its chest and pointing to itself as if to say, look how important I am. Whereas Freaks and Geeks just was, again, so matter of fact that for me that's much more impressive when you just do it as a matter of course rather than almost a, this is a very special episode or a very special storyline.
You mean more after school special?
Yeah, almost.
Like it always comes off more like that.
Yep. So, what about you, Perry? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I think you just answered it. This is a comedy. Judd Apatow is a comedy writer. He writes for comedic beats. The entire writing staff are comedy writers, but they're all comedy writers who have a deep appreciation for human frailty and flaws and aren't afraid to not just expose them, but to let people sit in them for a while and still find laughs around it while being serious. My So-Called Life was a drama through and through. I mean, yeah, there was funny stuff in it, but it was a drama. This is a comedy. And it's not to say it's not a comedy drama. It's both is the answer to your question. But being forced to pick one over the other, I think of it as a comedy.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Jay?
Yeah, I've grappled with this a little bit. I think it pulls – certainly it pulls us in with comedy in the first episode. You know, I think that's how they pull us into the show. And then it introduces the more dramatic elements as it goes along, including some rather tough and, you know, heart-rending stuff, you know, especially when you get to Kim Kelly's home life and Nick's home life and Daniel's, you know, punk crisis and all that kind of stuff. It's – so, I mean, maybe it's cheating to say it's a comedy drama, but I don't know. I kind of, on a different day, I might have a different answer. I almost want to think of it as a drama with comedic elements, but it can just go either way. And I think, like Perry said, you know, these were certainly the writers, I think, came more out of comedy, but they were writing it on a subject that they knew very well, their own growing up, and everything that came with that, which, of course, as we all know, unless we have a charmed life, that time of your life is comedy, it's drama, it's everything. And if you're just like they were, trying to depict it in an honest fashion, then you're going to get all that. You're going to get a full spectrum of human interaction. And so I think it works as both, certainly. So I don't know. I'm kind of wishy-washy on giving an exact answer, I suppose.
We're talking about this richness, and again, we only had 18 episodes, but what they wrought in those 18 episodes.
Yeah.
You know. So what about
it's
you, Aaron?
It's a minor miracle.
Oh, it is.
I will die on the hill of this show being a comedy. I think it's the greatest one-hour comedy. One-hour comedies are almost never done, but this is a one-hour comedy. It's, for a lack of a better term, an art house comedy, which means that sometimes it's really, really sad. But at the end of the day, there's no real tragedy. And even the serious moments, they're taken not to laugh at the characters to whom the ill is happening, but they are happening in a way that can create a joke later on. You don't have the big dramatic fights or the big dramatic breakdowns that you get in dramas so often. Everything always leads to a joke. I mean, even the premise of the show where every episode we're going to end with the characters not having a win is just them playing a joke on the sitcom. Yes, it's heavy. And there's a lot of really great raw material emotionally in it. But at the end of the day, I think it's a comedy.
All the tragedies are
Joe Flaherty.
Oh no, Joe Flaherty as Daddy Weir, as Harold Weir. He's got to have one of the great characters and one of the great recurring motifs. You know, anytime anything happens, or his kids want something, You know what happened to the boy that asked his father for $5 for pizza? He died. I know a man once who mowed his lawn. He died.
Yeah, that's how they got trapped.
You know what happened to the lady who asked her husband for the car keys? She slipped in the bathtub and she died. It's just, I mean, everything ends with somebody dying with that guy. It's one of the great dad roles ever. And it's not just comedy, you know. You get that moment after Mr. and Mrs. Weir have met Lindsay's new friends, the freaks, and he turns to his wife, and he doesn't even really turn. He just half turns. He's still too stunned at what he's just seen as they've all walked out the door together. And he says, oh, honey, this ain't good.
Or the talk that he has with Lindsay after they take Nick in for a week. And mm-hmm. she asks, why are you nicer to Nick than you are to me? I'm your daughter. And he just looks at her like he's shocked that he has to answer such a stupid question. And he says, because you have this life. I've made sure you've had this life, basically. And I expect more because Nick came out of garbage background and he doesn't know any better.
Yeah.
All Nick has is that hard-ass military father that nothing's ever going to please him. And apparently, you know, Lindsay's father must have had a pretty hard upbringing. You know, that's a really great moment. But I just want to take a minute here. For those who may not know the cast, let's just remember Linda Cardellini, John Francis Daly, James Franco, Sam Levine, Seth Rogen, Jason Segel, Martin Starr, Becky Ann Baker, Joe Flaherty, and Busy Phillips as the main cast. And then you have people like, well, Lizzie Kaplan had a recurring role, Tom Wilson as Coach Fredericks, a.k.a. Biff in the Back to the Future films. Claudia Christian from Babylon 5 comes on as Bill's mother in about 3 or 4 episodes. Sam McMurray and Dowd. The list goes on and on. You have, people like... Yeah, Ben Foster. Yeah. You have people like Shia LaBeouf, David Krumholtz, Jason Schwartzman, Ben Stiller,
Rashida Jones.
As guest stars. My God, and that's just the in front of the camera talent. You look at the fact that it's got Jake Kasdan as a producer and director. You know, it's got Feig as the creative force behind it, but also he's joined by people like Apatow and White. That's Mike White. He had Leslie Linka-Glater as a director on the show, Ken Kwapis. It's just this show has an embarrassment of riches in front of and behind the camera. So let's just take a moment and go, holy shit!
Yeah, really.
And
Sarah Hagen. I don't think you mentioned Sarah Hagen, who plays Millie.
Yeah.
Just an incredible find, you know.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I'm sure
she doesn't get any credit. Wow.
Yeah, I actually met her once on San Fernando Boulevard in Burbank. I was walking to a bagel shop or something. She was sitting outside, and I had to just say, you were so great on that show. You know, and that was the whole encounter, you know. But she really seemed to appreciate it, so I was glad I said something. But, and I haven't really seen her much in anything too much since, but... maybe they can't think of her as anything but Millie, but she really nailed that.
Yep. No, there are so
and
many.
She had
Go on.
She had a small arc on Buffy the Vampire Slayer a couple of years later,
that's right.
And that was pretty
that's
much
right.
her entire career.
Yeah.
So
you mentioned you mentioned the intersex plot line. That was mm-hmm. Jeff Campbell, who just died, you know, fairly recently,
yes.
Maybe a month ago. And she was phenomenal in the movie Election as well. And she stepped away from her career you know, to be a mother or something. I don't even know. But
I think I heard it was to be a mother, and because the illness that eventually claimed her life had presented itself,
well,
and she's been dealing with both of those, and it's really sad because she's so pretty young.
Yeah.
But a very memorable actress. I mean, just look at that. People that only got like two or three episodes, and you still remember the character and the story they had. And sure, it only has 18 episodes, but you know, I hate to say it, but you compare it to another short run show, which obviously that show was always meant to be short run, but and that's The Prisoner. And maybe you remember that this is the episode where this happens, or you remember that this is the episode with this number two or that number two. Somebody has my show on in the background. Could they turn it down?
My computer,
we're getting a little bit of feedback.
My computer just started, unbidden, I wasn't even on the tab, just started playing the
wow.
show.
No, so that's
sorry,
okay.
Sorry about that. I got it.
No, that actually happened to me once a few weeks ago, right at the beginning of a show. I think it's a Blog Talk thing. Blog Talk likes to take control and run away.
Well, yeah,
but
it's weird.
No worries. No hard feelings. It was just bizarre. All of a sudden, I'm like, "Whoa, echo chamber! Yay!" But
actually, I just got tired of listening to you, and I wanted to go back and listen to what I had already said.
So. No. So here's the next question: which, if any, character do you most relate to? And I'll go with you, Perry.
I don't know if I'm going to take the cheesy way out of this and say all of them. why the show works. I suppose if we were going to tag ourselves in high school, I would have certainly been one of the geeks, but I really can relate to Lindsay Weir, but I can also didn't we all know a Daniel Bessario? Didn't we all know a Bill Havercheck? Didn't we hang out with all of them, assuming, you know, we had any amount of social skills? So, yeah, I'm sorry to be so cheesy about it, but that's truthfully the answer. There is nobody on this show who gets talked down to as a character. Even the characters we don't like aren't monsters. We understand why they are that way. And that's why – and that's true for every single scene in every single episode. It's why the show lasts forever.
Mm-hmm. So, Sydney?
I guess my answer would kind of be both of the Weir siblings together, because I kind of relate to Lindsay more for like the high school experience part, because I was moved pretty, like I had a really nerdy childhood growing up, and then the minute high school started, I was moved cross country, uprooted completely. So I went from being the nerd who got all A's to I'm still pretty smart, but I was apathetic, and then I joined the theater kids. And those are the freaks at any school in the 90s and early 2000s. I don't know if it's different now. I'm not a teenager, nor do I have one. But I just relate to them a little bit more, at least the freaks in the episode, because I felt like one of them at the time. And I did want to say this one thing, though, about the dad. Even to an exaggerated extent, my father 1,000% did that to me growing up. 1,000%. I swear to God, he's like, if you smoke weed, you're going to die. If you have a cigarette, you're going to die. If you have a beer, you're going to die. Guess what, Dad? I've done all of them, and I'm still here.
You don't happen to the girl that asked for a pony? She died.
Died.
To be fair, he's not wrong.
But he
it just hasn't happened.
No. You die because you're stupid after you do those things. It's not because of those things. Remember, I was a kid of the 90s failed DARE program. So, you know.
So, Aaron, you?
Okay, so keeping in mind that I saw this show for the first time when I was 12 and that I was a pastor's kid, my two purview characters in this show were Sam, and Sam was a spirit animal because he got the pretty girl, which just was not going to happen for me when I was 12 years old. And Millie, who is the straight-laced, buttoned-up, prim and proper. As I watched it again, in my fourth or fifth time through the show, there's not a single character that I relate to more or less, though I have to admit that Mr. Rosso, as lame as he is actually a great educator in so many ways that people are missing because of how cheesy he is. He's really guiding, and I'm an educator now, so that's important to me. He's really guiding these kids in ways that they don't even understand, just by giving them an ear to listen.
So what about you, Jay?
Well, as I said before, I was in high school just a very few years before the characters in the show, and nothing much had changed, you know, in that interim. And so when I see that show, I think back and I'm like, well, I suppose Sam was the closest simply because at least at that age, because I too had, you know, a couple of good friends. We were definitely geeky into comics and TV and movies. No aptitude particularly or interest in sports. All our crushes were unrequited, you know, just that was so definitely that. But I certainly agree with I think Perry was the one making the point about how really all the characters are so relatable. In their own ways, even if you don't personally relate to them completely as just one character, you can see aspects, because that's the great thing about the show. It's very specific writing. You know, these characters are created with a lot of detail and specificity, but you know, the things they're going through and the situations that are in are completely universal. So you can't help but relate to all of them at one time or another, I think. But, you know, one answer would be this would be Sam. I even now that I think about it, when I was a little kid, I even called myself Cowboy Sam. That was my nickname for myself, because I liked to dress up like a cowboy, a little six gun. But, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, enough about my weird childhood, but anyway.
So the next question I want to ask, and I'll go to Perry for this, is what was the most unexpected element in the series for you?
Boy, there's so many good answers here. Let's go with I hope we get to talk about it later. I'll make sure we do. And I want to talk about, again, how really great everybody in this cast is. I'll get back to it later. But I guess I'll say I was surprised going through it. To get back to the very first or the or second question, how sad it was, how comfortable it was to sit in discomfort and sadness, and not in a way that was played for laughs, in a way that you experience the discomfort and the sadness. It's one of my great joys that this didn't go on based on, you know, all of the interviews they've given, and you would have found out how sad all of their lives would have turned out. That would have been depressing. If they kept on that arc for all of those characters, especially the freak, which seems to be exactly where they thought this was going to go. I'm happy to let it live where it lives. and to not get any deeper into that sadness, because then I think it might have stopped being a comedy. But that really is. It's just how well they balance the comedy and the drama. I cannot think of a network television show that pulled it off as well as that show does, ever. And to vacillate between them within the same episode. It wasn't like they had to stop and say, this is the serious episode. They could go back and forth on a dime, and they do repeatedly, and it's just stunning. Every time I go back through it, there's a moment in that episode that I'd forgotten about. I'm like, oh, that's so good. That's so good.
Well, look at the episode where the kid finds out, where Neil finds out about his dad and the affair.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even, like I said, like my – I use the quote at the front because I think it's – I'll go ahead and be stupidly over the top about this. It is one of my favorite lines in anything ever, television, movie. When he walks in that room and he says, I've never played on a kid that small. That's a funny line. That's why it's a comedy. But, oh, my God, the horror of what is about to unfold is all let out. You understand that character to the core in that moment. With a line that is a laugh line, but it is so true. It's so true to that character, and that moment happens throughout the show, throughout the entire run of the show. It's so good. I'm just gushing.
So, Aaron, you?
It's warmth. The comedy in the late 90s and early 2000s was a very mean brand of comedy. And there was so much love and empathy in this show. And even when a character was getting spit on, you felt for them. You weren't laughing at them. You were feeling sorry for them and then laughing later about it with them and their friends about what a stupid situation it was. There's an episode where Bill almost dies because is it Chauncey? No, that's the actor's name.
The character was Alan. The one that was the nominal bully of the show.
Yes. Alan feeds him a peanut because he thinks that Bill's just flirting with the cute teacher by talking about his allergies, because apparently that's what he thinks flirting is, because in his heart he's as nerdy as the geeks are. It's just really funny, but also really tragic at the same time. And there's just moments like that throughout the entire series where it's not cringe comedy, it's not mean, but there are uncomfortable moments that make you squirm, like the one Barry was just talking about, when you realize this is going to be a disaster. And I can't wait to see it, even though I'm squirming in my seat. But you still feel truly bad for Nick, because Nick is the lovable loser. He's the guy that you want to succeed, but know is not going to, because he just gave that up at some point, probably around the time he traded basketball for drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, Sydney?
For me, I think it was about how accessible it was for being, I guess, what you could ostensibly call a period piece, considering, you know, it was 20 years after it was set, almost. And obviously that was not my childhood, but it didn't feel like the need to do what some other stuff did at the time, where it's like, I'm going to over-explain this reference and beat the fashion home to you with, like, a lead pipe. It was very understated and let things speak for themselves. And if you didn't know it, they were still really good at writing to the point where context clues did it all for you. And at the time, considering all the, I guess you could call this a coming of age show, considering all the other stuff that was coming out in the 90s, like cough, Dawson's Creek, it didn't feel heavy-handed at all, and I was really impressed with that.
So, Jay?
Yeah, you know, picking up on that a little bit, the show could get heavy, but yeah, I didn't feel heavy-handed. And I think in terms of unexpected, now maybe it's because, you know, the Kim Kelly Is My Friend episode was originally supposed to be the fourth episode. Of course, now is the fourth episode in the restored as it's meant to be version. But NBC wouldn't air it. I think they thought it was too, you know, kind of rough stuff and maybe would throw people off about what the show was or what they wanted the show to be seen as. So I didn't see that. I guess none of us really saw that, even those time, until ABC Family picked it up, or maybe on DVD, or maybe on Netflix, or now on Hulu. But it really is kind of a jolt to see that episode, because everyone is so unlikable, and you know, her family and the conflicts are so intense. And I can kind of see NBC's point to a certain degree, I think, because it really does maybe give you an impression of the show that doesn't fit the rest of the show in a lot of ways, or it's a more condensed version of the dramatic elements. You know, not throughout. The episode still has a lot of funny stuff in it. It's still the show, but I think that was when I saw that, you know, in syndication, or ABC Family, whatever it's called, syndication. That was sort of an eye-opener. And then, of course, there are specific unexpected moments like the intersex plot line, you know. But I think that all kind of goes back, though, to the overall point here that we've all been making in a lot of these questions about how they blended comedy and drama so well, and how week to week you never knew quite what the balance was going to be, but you always knew you were going to have these great characters and you were going to be in their lives and caring about what happened to them. And I don't think I expected that of many shows in 1999 on network television.
No, very, very few. I mean, and that season it was basically everybody waiting for the next season of The Sopranos, going through the first season of The West Wing, and yeah, that was about it. Because ER was starting to show signs of wear by then. You know, it was a damn special show.
Oh my God, what is
really
the,
really?
Yeah, I think there was. I was trying to remember actually. Yeah, ER was the big show, right? Friends, Frasier, Raymond, right? NYPD Blue, Law and Order. I mean, a lot of good shows. X Files, Ally McBeal. All popular and critical hits, but Freaks and Geeks felt nothing
the city.
Like any of those.
X-Files.
Yeah. So, you know, it obviously wasn't, in a way, it was not in step with what the public seemed to be wanting. It was different. It was tonally diverse. It had no stars. And NBC clearly didn't know what to do with it or understand its appeal at some level. I think the executive there, Garth Hanciere, was a – I remember reading, he was a private school guy. He didn't understand any of this, you know, stuff. And they moved the show around a lot, and it just didn't fit. It was a square peg, to name another show, I guess. it's a shame that he couldn't figure out. But at the same time, like we've also said, would we want more of it? You know, in a perfect world, I used to think I would, but now I'm like, I don't know. It's I don't like the ending. I'm with Sydney. I don't care for how Lindsay ends up, maybe because I'm not a Grateful Dead fan, you know? But I just, you know, I wished it had a different ending, but whether another season or two or three would have helped anything, I doubt it. It would just probably, like most shows, it just would have probably gotten worse. What was special about it would have just become rote, and it would probably wouldn't have any kind of the same kind of memory we have of it now.
Yeah, very, very, very few shows, you know, maintain an overall quality level, or even, and even rarer is the show that gets better as it goes along.
Yeah,
there's a few and I'm not going to get into them right now, but as much as I love this show, my fear is that it would have its overall legacy would have been hurt had it continued even one more season. So that brings us to the next question, and I'll throw this to Perry. What was your favorite story on the show?
I thought long and hard about this, and you know what? I can't pick just one. There's a couple of them though. I am always surprised when I go back through it how long they let play out Sam's crush and him getting the girl, and then it just not working at all. I love how that's done. They take it so slow, and it feels so remarkably plausible. Any other show would have rushed that and would have gotten them together quicker and would have kept them together longer, and it knew enough not to do that. I marvel at that. It is remarkable how much Nick takes up in the show. Every time I go back through it, I realize how much of the show is Nick, and how Nick really affects everything in the show. That's always a surprise and a pleasure. Let's see. And I absolutely love. I could pick any number of things. I love the episode as was talking earlier about Jeff Ross. Mr. Ross is such a great character, and that entire episode devoted to where they're trying to see the cover band and find out it's his band is so good. that joke pays off every single time I see it.
He does to those kids, you feel for them, and yet you are you're going, yep, he did the right thing. He did absolutely the right thing.
He does not humiliate them other than to themselves. He only makes them feel bad about themselves. He doesn't make the group, he doesn't make the whole crowd turn on him, which is really great.
It's wonderful stuff.
I 100 other things, but I'll stop talking with those.
Yep. So, Sydney, your choice?
The best storyline? Oh, God.
Or your favorite?
My favorite? I don't know if you would consider it a storyline since it was just one episode, but it's my favorite episode out of the whole show. I will consistently rewatch the Halloween episode over and over and over again because, it's just so good, especially, is it Bill? Is he Martin Starr's character?
Yeah,
as the bionic woman and his little mirror sequence. I can't. If I am sad at any point in my life, I'll either watch that scene or watch the bloopers for that scene, and I'm immediately happy. Because it is one of the best, just the best comedy I think I've ever seen, and I know it's simple, but, oh, God, give me that scene 85 times. I'm happy.
So, Jay?
Could you say that again into my bionic ear? Yeah, that's I'm born on Halloween, so I'm predisposed to anything Halloween, I suppose. But that is definitely a great one. But yeah, you really can't go wrong almost with this show. I love I'm with the band. I love the one where they get the girl to hang out with them. The wonderful girl who just hangs with them, and they just fall for her, and she becomes popular.
The Billy Joel episode.
I can't remember that girl. That girl's name, yeah, that actress's name, I want to say Kayla Yule or something like that. She was on the first season of Vampire Diaries, too, where she gets killed in the first episode and becomes a ghost or something. But anyway, I think it's the only other thing I've seen her in. But I think, and picking up on the Sam and Cindy arc, you know, how, like you were saying, how that was kind of dragged out over the season. And I think in a way that made it more believable because, frankly, you know, I don't look at those two and think, oh, you know, there's a match made in heaven. He seems like he's 5 years younger than her. You know, he's a foot tall, shorter than her. And in some ways, when they first introduced the storyline, I thought this is going to be an unrequited thing. He's got no shot here. She's a cheerleader. He's a geek. And the fact that they make that even remotely believable as the show goes along was quite a feat, I think.
Yeah.
And then the way they, you know, resolved it all was just perfect as well. But I don't know that I have any one favorite thing. You know, it's just all so good.
And you, Aaron?
I'm going to twist the question and make it about an episode, which is The Little Things, which is the episode with the intersex material, and also the episode in which Sam dumps Cindy. The Sam and Cindy, as Jay and Barry have both pointed out, is really one of the only through lines through the series. There's very little serial element to this, other than character work. And so the way that pays off as both a poignant moment in Sam's development as a human, but also just a really funny moment where Cindy can't get through the introduction of George Bush because she's crying after a Little Sam Weir dumped her. But then the really heavy, poignant stuff with Ken and Amy, and Ken going through this identity crisis and like, does this make me gay? And if it does, am I okay with that?
Yeah.
And Seth Rogen really, really does an incredible job with this episode.
Yeah.
He is so vulnerable, so open. And this is his first role ever. And he was utilized very little throughout most of the series. He was kind of just Daniel and Nick's third wheel a lot of the series, and then he comes out of left field and perhaps gives the best performance of the entire series in this episode. And it all leads to this one little talk in the boys' bathroom at the school between Ken and Sam, and they're talking to each other because they're both bummed out, because they're both thinking about dumping their girlfriends. And Ken asks Sam why he's going to dump his girlfriend, and Sam goes through all of the very good reasons why. And he says, what's wrong? And Ken, to everything, is like, well, my girlfriend doesn't do that. She's pretty cool that way. And Sam's like, then what's your problem? And Ken says, you know, I don't know. And they make up. And Ken and Amy make up, even though Ken has been a total tool for most of the episode. And it just gives you that resolution, which there's very little resolution. As I said earlier, the show makes a point not to have victories for their characters. And so in this episode, you see the paths crossing in that bathroom, where Sam's victory the episode before becomes his first breakup, and Ken's really low start to the episode becomes a win, and then Lindsay gets the last word on George Bush, which is very satisfying.
and Ben Stiller makes a great guest appearance as secret agent and has a weird
side. I should have had a different career.
A weird side story with Mr. Russo, and it's the best episode in the series.
So, usually when we're approaching the 2-hour mark, I like to do some housekeeping. But since this is going to be a shorter episode, before we get into the what I think is going to take about another 15 to 30 minutes of the show, I do want to take some time and say that on Deviant Legion Network, we have some things coming up over the next couple weeks. On the 27th, we have the DLN Black History Month special, which is a Putney Swope commentary watch. on the 1st, Limes Marshall's show, Terror with a Twist of Limes, will feature the very special guest of Dee Wallace.
Wow.
So that will be very, very, very worth taking a listen to, folks. I think that's going to be a fantastic interview. And in 2 weeks from tonight, Cathode Ray Mission is back, and it will feature a discussion on the films and career of Steven Spielberg. So that's what's coming up here over the next couple weeks on DLN. Now, back to our regularly scheduled program. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the characters and the cast, but seriously, where does this cast rank among the all-time greats? Jay?
Well, the short answer would be very high, I think. as I said before, there was nobody in this thing was really known among the, at least among the kids, right? You would recognize Tom Wilson and Claudia Christian and Kevin Tye and some of these supporting players and Joe Flaherty, of course. But the core cast, the kids, which carried the show, they were nobodies, and of course that didn't change. That did change big time, which I noticed that the only Emmy the show ever won was for casting, and it only got two other nominations for Feig's pilot and the last episode. So that's a whole other thing. But they were a huge group of new talent, bright futures, obviously. And it's just amazing to me how they did that. You know, you mentioned Seth Rogen in the Little Things episode and how good he was. And I wonder, I would love to be on a fly on the wall in the writer's room of this show. I know that Feig rejiggered the pilot after casting to sort of fit the actors to the roles somewhat rather than the other way around, and that must have paid off as they went along. And I just wonder if maybe like in the case of Seth Rogen, who was 15 or 16 when he was cast, he was actually closer in age to the geeks than the freaks, and he did stand-up comedy, but he had no acting experience, and I don't know that he would have even been up to the challenges of the Little Things if it were an earlier episode in the season. But by the time you get the episode, whatever that is, it's in the teens, right? He was seven. He was ready to rise to the challenge of what they were giving him, and I think that seemed to be true in some of the other cases too. I think in the pilot, sometimes I think I see Sam and the geeks in general maybe playing a little bit broader than they would even in episode two. Some of that's just it's a pilot, and you're trying to find the style and the voice and the tone and everything. But, everybody just nailed it, and their further, their continued success is evidence that it was a great cast. Among the all-time greats, I wouldn't want to try to do a ranking. You know, obviously there are a lot of shows that have a lot of great casts, but like I said before, it's very, very high.
So, Sydney?
Oh, this is probably the very top of my list in terms of best cast, and for me it's the top because there's literally no one in the opening credits, in the principal cast, even some of the supporting, and you've mentioned guest roles. There's almost no one involved in this show that doesn't have name recognition now. And for me, even all of my favorite shows, there's always one to four people even that, one, usually only like one or two of the mains get a big career afterwards. And then there's always those other people that even when I was watching the show, I was like, I either don't like you as an actor, or I don't like your character, or I don't like both. And this show has none of that. I can't complain about it, which is odd for me because I also like complaining about things. So,
oh yeah,
it's really hard for me to dislike this show no matter how many times I rewatch it. And that is a little frustrating for me on a personal level. I want to hate something. Damn it.
It is nice to have nearly perfectly crafted things every now and then. It's almost it's something almost aspirational when you find something this lovely. Aaron mentioned it's humanity, it's empathy, but you know he's right. But I think you could also extend that to there's almost like a glow that emanates from this show. It's a very special show. It really is. So, Aaron will be next. So, Aaron, where does this cast rank among the all-time greats?
I'm going to sidestep this ever so slightly. It is the most consequential young cast ever in a TV show. The performers in this show all went on to become superstars, except for possibly Sam Levin, who is an actor still. He still has name recognition, but I don't think he ever could be considered a superstar. I mean, even like John Francis Daly is writing and directing now big time movies. He had that 10-year run on Bones. So even the geeks, Martin Starr is unquestionably a huge face in comedic television right now. It's a very, very consequential cast. Now, that sounds like a cop-out, but it's not, because what they did with this young cast is unbelievable. None of these people would have the careers they have without Freaks and Geeks. In fact, Jason Segel was cast in How I Met Your Mother without an audition because of this show. So, and that's, you know, arguably what really launched them into another planet. James Franco, Spider-Man immediately after this, Seth Rogen attached himself to Judd Apatow until he outgrew Apatow. Which is unfair to Judd Apatow as well, because he's done some wonderful work.
And let's be honest, 40-Year Virgin is actually a good movie.
Yes. So it's not.
Oh, it's a brilliant movie.
So, like I said, I think he gets unfairly marginalized, as I think comedy writers and directors often do. It's an incredible cast, and it's a consequential cast, and now I guess I'll stop blathering.
And now Perry.
I cannot add anything more to all of that. It's absolutely true. It's one of the best casts ever. It's, yeah, probably the greatest cast of unknowns ever put together for a television show. So I'm going to use my time to praise three people in particular on this show, because one of the most fun conversations I've ever had was a long time ago with some coworkers about who is the best performer on the show. I'm not saying they're the best actor or actress ever, just who is first among equals on this cast, on this show. And I couldn't get the list smaller than three. And I'm going to tell you why for each of them. Linda Cardellini carries this show. If you don't buy her, this all falls apart. She is the center. It is her story that we follow through the year. It is her identity crisis that triggers the vast majority of the show. And she is so good throughout this as both a comedic and dramatic actress without changing that much between those two gears. She just I can't tell when it's going to be a dramatic scene or a comedic scene. She's remarkable. And then the other two that I think are so unsung, I'm glad somebody else loves Martin Starr, because Bill Havercheck is one of the greatest creations in the history of television. He is so un-television looking. I don't know many teenagers who would be, and yes, he was older, but still, who would let themselves look that uncomfortable on screen and let that seem completely natural. Like all of those guys we knew that were like that. It's just a remarkable piece of that. Even his comedic timing is so weird. It's wonderful. It sells so much.
And when you see him in other things, even other things around that time, you realize just how much of a performance that is, and it's phenomenal.
Yeah,
it's really extraordinary.
I forget which episode it is. There's that weird conversation at the end. They're in the lunchroom, and so they go, "Guess what I found? I can't remember what it is. A turd? Yes, Bill, a turd. Ooh." It's so well delivered and so oddly timed. It's beautiful. And the actress who nobody talks about, the truest looking human being on the screen through the entire run of the show, Becky Ann Baker, is that person through and through. She looks like every mama. She looks like my mom. My mom was much hipper than that, but she just looked like every Michigan mom I ever knew, and behaves like it in some remarkable elemental way that just grounds everything around her. She never, and she so beautifully plays, with Joe Flaherty, that, by being this not mousy, she's not a wallflower. She just is very comfortable with what she is and who she is, and she really loves her kids. She really loves her husband. And he's allowed to be this, often cantankerous character because she is just this incredibly present center through all of it. It's an outstanding, and I don't mean this insultingly. It feels like an artless performance. I mean that to say it's incredibly artful. I never catch her acting, just like I never catch Martin Starr acting in this show ever. It's so good. The three of them are my first three among equals.
The art of being is not to be ignored. So finally, we come to the last of the prep questions for the show, and that is, I'm going to direct this first to Sydney. Where does this fit in with the evolution of quality TV, this so-called modern era of TV, where TV supposedly sometime around The Sopranos suddenly leapt forward? Where do you think it fits in?
As in, like, my personal list, or in general.
In general, you can take the question however you want.
Well, obviously I came to it later, so it's a little hard for me to judge the impact at the time, but obviously it's now a cult favorite. I find very few people in my life that don't know it exists. That's a very small number. But I don't know, I just feel like it hit the sweet spot when it was on, but it also missed it because it got canceled. And so I just like it in terms of its impact now, because I don't know if it actually successfully, obviously it didn't, made an impact when it was on. But it was in the sweet spot where it was all happening, and maybe there was too much overload at the time for it to get through. Because TV was getting really, really good again around then.
So, Jay, your thoughts?
Well, of course, I was around then, as I said before, I was grown man, you know, watching this show. And now I don't know at the time I thought of it in terms of quality television, you know, the way you're talking about, even though I certainly
was aware. Yeah, and that's a term that I'm using just so that we know what we're talking about, because it's not a term I really like, but yeah.
Right. Because when I was growing up, quality television was basically PBS, Masterpiece
Theater,
exactly. All that stuff. And then, you know, I Claudius and Elizabeth and all this stuff. And then I think maybe a little bit later I started thinking of it in terms of some of those great TV movies of the early 70s, and then you had all the great CBS comedies that came in. I always thought of that as kind of a renaissance, you're certainly quality television era. But in terms of the modern way that we're thinking of it, I don't know when, you know, maybe Hill Street Blues and some of that stuff, but maybe that's even too early for this conversation. But when Freaks and Geeks debuted in 1999, and as we were saying before, that was a very rich period. I mean, even on the networks, you know, you look at the top shows, and there's a lot of strong material there. And Freaks and Geeks was, at minimum, as high a quality, I think higher quality than anything else on there, you know, at that time. But it didn't seem to be in step with what the public wanted. So I think its influence and the way it fits into the quality television question, perhaps, is that it had a phenomenal impact on the creative community, if not the, you know, the suits and the networks and even the audience. I think it really hit a chord creatively, and all those people kept getting work and became establishment in a way, in their own way. And it was a little bit too unique. They can never quite build on it in terms of quality television. You know, they did Undeclared shortly after, which was still Apatow and a lot of the people involved with Freaks and Geeks. But it was a great show, but it wasn't particularly successful either. And it seemed like it took all those people getting into movies to really bring Freaks and Geeks thing to fruition. The drawback being, of course, in a movie, you only have 2 hours to tell a story, not 18 or 22 or whatever you would like. And so it's they could never quite, I don't know that they were even trying to, but you can't quite capture that lightning in a bottle in the movies, even as good as some of those Apatow and Teague movies are. But, I think Sydney probably hit it. It didn't quite become a true avatar of quality television of that time. It's something that a lot of us appreciated at the time, but a lot of people came to appreciate it much later and are still coming to it. So, I don't know. Not a very precise answer, but that's all I got.
Certainly. Perry?
It is this beautiful, freakish jewel that landed at a time when it needed to land. I don't think of it as being, you know, part of that continuum, because nobody's tried to do it. There's been no show like it since. Nobody survived this. And so it is this utter standalone thing because, and this is my own prejudice talking, television is not, I have the prejudice that television, network television, is not a storytelling medium. It just isn't. And these are storytellers. And so they were always going to gravitate to film. And that's where they have all shined. And that's all I'm going to say about that.
Yeah, it was an outlier, you know, and it couldn't. And I think the failure of it, ratings wise, did keep it from being influential on television at that time.
Yeah, you know, it's almost a case of it was. I hate to use the cliche, but too good for television, which of course really means it was too good for the suits. And who are, of course, it's their job to worry about numbers and making money. But, you know, it was not something the suits were going to be comfortable with. And it wasn't something that mass audiences were going to easily gravitate towards, particularly not at that time, given, as we've discussed, the state of comedy on U.S. television at the time. It was a time where everything, where a lot of things were mean, which some people have pointed to as a legacy of Seinfeld, but I think it's actually a legacy of people misunderstanding what Seinfeld was really about. Now, that's not to say that Seinfeld wasn't a mean-spirited show, but Seinfeld was never a show that did what some of the comedies in the late 90s and early 2000s did, where it looked at the audience and punched the audience in the face and then went, ha ha, now that's funny. Seinfeld just was its own thing. And, you know, but that's a topic for another show. So, Aaron, you? Where do you think this fits?
To do my best Ruth Bader Ginsburg impression, I dissent. I think this show utterly changed the landscape of American television comedy. I think it was a seed because, yes, it died, but it planted something that has not left the DNA of, for lack of a better term, the sitcom. Look at the best comedies that have come out recently from Master of None and Atlanta, Mrs. Maisel. And yes, they are premium shows, they're streaming shows, but they all have that really intense human drama mixed with truly like gut-busting comedy. And I don't think any of those shows exist without Freaks and Geeks. And I know Atlanta doesn't, because I know Donald Glover is a huge fan. I think that the lack of popularity is a little deceiving, because how many shows with 18 episodes to their credit ever reach syndication? Freaks and Geeks did the summer after it was canceled. People knew that this show was important. People knew that it was great. It just wasn't able to find its audience because NBC screwed it up so badly. They moved it from week to week, to different nights, to different time spots. Well, of course it had bad ratings. You didn't know when you were going to find it. So I don't – this show to me is as important as a comedy as The Sopranos was to drama. And that they came out the same year, I think, speaks to – the evolution of television and getting to what we now call peak TV, which is also kind of a dreadful term, but I think is what you're getting at with the quality television. I absolutely think that this played a part in that revolution that has resulted in the golden age of television. As has been, I think, reclaimed from about 99 to 2015 or so.
Mm-hmm. So now we come to the part of the show that I always like to do. Is there anything that we haven't mentioned yet that you'd like to hit on really quickly? And I'll start with you, Perry.
Gosh. I mean, I could pick something we haven't talked about yet because I could talk about anything on this show. Let's talk about how good the music cues are. You know, for a show, Sydney mentioned it earlier, how unselfconsciously it set itself in 1980. It does not make a huge point about it. And even the song choices are not, you know, they're not obvious. You know, I love that Billy Joel episode, in addition to being a Billy Joel fan, because it's a lot of deep cuts from glass houses. You know, they knew what they were doing. They let you live in this stuff. You know, all of the songs that the band plays are on point. They that the entire "I'm with the Band" episode hinges on Alice Cooper's 18. It's fantastic. It was smart in every possible way, including the soundtrack. And it's smart and not showy about it, just like everything else. There. Let's praise the soundtrack.
Well, fair enough. So, Sydney?
Okay, I do have to – I had something else in mind, but I do also have to agree with you on the soundtrack because that is one of my all-time favorite parts. And – about it, like, I rock out to the soundtrack every time I rewatch it. Classic rock is my jam. And one of my all-time favorite scenes in terms of music is when Jason Segel is singing Lady. And it's now one of my all-time, it is one of my all-time favorite songs just because of that scene, which is rare. But I was going to say something we haven't talked about. We've all been saying around, like, singing its praises, as we should, because it is a great show. But no one's mentioned anything that they don't like, and I do have a couple. I really dislike the ending. It's one of my top five most hated endings. Lindsay deserved better. You know, I'm sorry. That I'm going to die on that hill till the day I die. And we've all been saying, like, how, and I agree, the intersex episode is probably the one of the least pretentious. But I think they were only able to do that well because they messed up with such a self-congratulatory storyline within, like, I want to say the first episode or maybe the second, but it was so self-congratulatory in the storyline where Lindsay asked the mentally handicapped kid to homecoming, and it was after school special. So it was done appropriately, especially for 98, 99, probably when it was written or filmed. So, looking back at it, that was ahead of its time, but it was also very, you know, Saved by the Bell after school special, don't do drugs, kids. So,
can I say something to that point?
Mm-hmm.
I disagree that it's self-congratulatory because Lindsay got her butt kicked for that. Because she ends up looking like the bad guy because nobody saw her getting him getting bullied, and he didn't understand that he was being bullied. So everyone sees her as the bad guy, and I mean, even the audience looking at it says, yeah, "Come on, Lindsay, that's bad. That's in bad taste." And yeah, I mean, for in the 90s, maybe it looked different. But I don't know. I see that as being more real than self-congratulatory.
Yeah.
But do you maybe mean in the sense of, I mean, she does sort of fix the situation, and she winds up dancing with him at the dance, and everything's hunky-dory.
Yeah, it felt like it was too neat a bow for me, I guess, because the rest of the show didn't feel like – a lot of the big, quote-unquote, traumatic elements ever fully got immediately resolved, if they did, or even resolved at all.
I wonder if Paul Feig or Apatow has ever spoken to this, because, you know, like you said, it's in the first episode, I think the first two episodes, and he's gone. He's not even an extra, you know what I mean, beyond that. And I wonder if either if it was them or the network saying, this is not working. Let's readjust here. Let's, you know, it'd be interesting to know, but I don't think I've ever seen an interview where they addressed it. Maybe on some of the extras on the DVD. I don't know.
So next up, you, Jay, anything you want to mention that we haven't covered yet?
Nothing big coming to mind. I think, as we were talking, one little comparison occurred to me. You know, we were talking about how the characters were so dimensional, and even the bad ones the ones we're not necessarily liking when we first introduce them, we come to at least understand them. And if this is not too lofty a reference, because I'm sure Feig and Apatow didn't have it in mind, but it makes me think of Jean Renoir, the films of Jean Renoir, and how famously people said about his films that, you know, everybody has their reasons and there are no heroes and no villains. And I think in its own way, this show really sort of ran with that idea. And it was probably, I think it's one of one of the main things we love about it now, and probably one of the main things that made it a hard sell back then. It was always going to be a hard sell, because I'm sure a lot of adults looked at this pilot and said, well, what do I want to see a show about a bunch of high schoolers for? And then high schoolers probably looked at it and said, what, 1980, what do I care, you know? and yet, you know, here we are still talking about it and loving it, and it's got a big splashy return on Hulu with the original music cues restored and a lot of press. And,
and Chow Factory put out a new Blu-ray.
Yep. Oh, right, yeah. Yeah, so.
Yeah, which I picked up.
A happy ending,
Really, really is. Definitely a happier ending than the series itself. Holy shit. So finally, to you, Aaron, anything you want to mention that we haven't covered yet?
Two small things. The ending's getting dragged quite a bit. And I would like to point out that it was originally written as a dual finale, because they did not know if it was going to be the season or series finale. So they wanted something that could be looked at as a touchstone if it was canceled, but also something that would lead to their ideal second season. So
anytime
that a show gets canceled after 18 episodes, you're going to have somewhat of a disappointing ending. For me, like, the ultimate disappointing ending is Veronica Mars, which just leaves so many questions up. And to me, this feels a little more complete than that, because they knew it was a possibility, but they didn't know that it was an inevitability. And so I think that plays into it. Let me interrupt you real quick before
you finish your next thought. I have mixed feelings on the finale. I love 2/3 of it. And when I first saw it, I actually thought, you know, I hate that Lindsay made this choice, but I think it feels right for where she was at. And, coming back to it on my revisit recently, I still feel the same way about the first two parts. But while I can say that about Lindsay's story, you know, it didn't hit me as emotionally hard as it did the first time, maybe because I knew it was coming, but it just felt kind of like, so they went there. So for me, it's not that I thought it was bad as much as it was just another story. So that's me and my response. So my response is not nearly as positive as yours, but nowhere near as negative as everyone else. Because I just thought that
for the record, I'm real positive on the ending. I really like the last episode. I'm real good with.
Oh, okay. So you did. Okay,
I
excellent.
Like what they did a lot. I'm fine with it living in that space.
Yep. So Aaron, please continue.
My other point was just really small and shallow, and that's that Linda Cardellini was like my first TV crush. So we can leave it at that.
we all have our first crushes. I mean, hell, I was a little kid, and I think the first time I really realized I liked, well, you know, they always say that you know whether you like men or women when you're very young. I was about 2 years old, and I saw The Beastmaster, and I saw Tanya Roberts in that, and I was like, yep, I like women. That was my first crush. So, yeah. But, no, I have to say, I think this was a fun little show for us to do. Definitely covered a lot of great points, good conversation. You know, as always, I want to thank everyone for coming aboard and having this conversation, for everybody out there listening. You know, I hope you'll all be back next week to listen, and we'll definitely have each of you back on future episodes. Some of you a little sooner than others. Perry and Aaron will be on our Spielberg episode. Sydney, there's a few episodes she may be interested in, including the oft-delayed West Wing episode, which for those with long memories may say, wait, wasn't that supposed to be in March? Yeah, however, some of the guests that we had lined up for that are having scheduling difficulties, and to be 100% honest, I wanted to have a complete revisit of the show, which I would have managed by now had the guests worked out, but they didn't, so I'm taking that really slow, and we're looking at the West Wing possibly sometime in late summer or early fall. So that's what's happening there. But again, I want to, and Jerry, you know, Jay will be back at some point, I'm sure. You know, we'll always find something for you from time to time.
I'm sure there's some other show or thing. Yeah, always down.
Yeah, I mean, after Spielberg, we've got an episode on the Danish series Borgen. Then we're working up episodes on some Japanese directors and an episode on a person of interest. So, you know.
Oh, wonderful.
Those are some of the ones coming up over the next couple months.
That's a good. Oh, cool.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I'll have my people call your people. Yeah.
Excellent. You do that. And we'll have virtual lunch.
Yay.
But only this time it's not a brush off. So yes.
Okay.
It's genuine. So yes. All that said, I want to thank everyone, and on the count of three we can say good night. One, two, three. Good night, folks.
Good night.
Good night, folks.
Bye-bye.
Bye.